Okay, welcome everyone to this seminar called The Heirs, the Managers and the Bureaucrats, Sketching Economic Power in Contemporary France. My name is Mike Savage. I am Professor of Sociology at the LSE. I'm also a convener of a theme of research which is run by the International Inequalities Institute around wealth, elites and tax justice. And before we begin the seminar, I want to say briefly a little bit about the collaboration which has produced not just this seminar, but two more to come later this term, which is that over the last few months, a number of research groups in different European countries have been collaborating and thinking about how to develop a comparative research project on elites, not just in specific nations, but more generally across Europe and also at some point in the future across the world as a whole. And we thought in order to develop this project, it would be good to get different research teams from European nations talking about their research findings so far, so that we can begin to know more about each other's work and begin to think about how we might build upon this and take things forward. And I also want to say, if you're interested in these themes and if you want to get involved in this collaborative research project, we do have a working paper published by the International Inequalities Institute, which reports a number of projects which we've been involved with, which offer the kind of the platform on which this collaboration is being built. So it's an invitation, a welcome to you all to read more and to talk to us and get involved in our work if it interests you. So please do contact me by email if you want to, if you're not part of the group so far, but you wish to be. Okay, that's enough about the collaboration. Let's move on to today's seminar. And today's speakers are Francois Denoir, who is Research Director of CNRS in Paris, Paul Lano-Imone, who's the Associate Professor in Sociology at Paris Dauphine, and Sylvain Tyne, who is a Research Associate at the Centre of European Sociology in Paris. And these three scholars are amongst the leading sociologists in France working on elites and thinking about how we develop concepts and methods which allow us to analyse elites in the French context. So before I pass on to Paul will be speaking on behalf of the group, but all three speakers are here and will be answering questions. Just a few things before we begin, a few formalities. So this online event is being recorded and live streamed on the LSE IEI Facebook page, and it will be made available as a video and a podcast, so long as the technology allows that. This seminar is a Zoom seminar and not webinar, which means that when we come to discussion, we'll be able to see your faces and you'll be able to put your hands up and speak in kind of real time rather than by the chat function. But if you want to put questions in the chat while the seminar is being given, please do that and we can pick up on those in the discussion period. I should also say we are anticipating the seminar finishing at about 1:45 our time. We might be able to go on a bit longer if lots of questions, but I think Paul will be speaking for about 45 minutes and that will allow about half an hour for discussion. So that's probably what we're aiming for. And finally, before we move on, I need to do some publicity to say that loads of things happening at the IEI. Next Tuesday at 12:30, we're holding a seminar entitled Faces of Inequality, a Mixed Methods Approach to Multidimensional Inequalities, which is part of the IEI seminar series. This time next week, we're having the second of these seminars, looking at collaborations around European elites, and that is a seminar on career hubs as corporate global networks. And you can see from the chat function that these are being listed there. So hopefully that's all clear. I'm going to pass on to Paul now to talk about the heirs, the managers, and the bureaucrats. Okay, Paul.
Thank you, Mike. And thank you very much. First of all, François, Sylvain, and I would like to thank Nina, Victoria, and Mike for organizing this seminar. And we would, I would like also to thank Marta and Azif for our exchanges in these last weeks. They help us in the making of this draft, which is very much a work in progress. So let's start. The presentation will fall into four parts, and the plan is not very original. A bit of background, then we will insist on the sources and methods. We will present you preliminary results, and we'll try to address in this discussion section the so what question, or should I say the so what questions, because there are a lot of S's to the so what implication. So a bit of background first. We could say that there are, I mean, basically three main perspectives that frame how social scientists address the question of economic power, career, market, and influence. The first perspective derives from the study of social mobility mainly. It focuses on the paths to occupations that combine money, prestige, and agency, and the kind of question that we usually address in this stream of the literature is what are the social conditions for accessing these eminent positions. The units of observation may be variables that characterize socioeconomic position. Think about like the categories in a mobility table, for instance, or selection processes such as recruitment, promotion, or co-optation that you can qualitatively analyze. The second perspective draws from the literature in economic sociology. And the kind of question here would be something like, under which conditions a given industry or market is tilted in favor of a specific group of actors, usually firms. The units of observation are usually the rules of exchanges, the rules of the market, or the oppositions in a network of business and sometimes non-strictly economic relations between firms and crucial individuals. The third perspective stems from the political sociology of capitalist institutions. And here the question would be something like, what are the relationships between the resources, individual or collective, of corporations and their ability to control policy making? The units of the observations are often firms' political donations when available, like in the US, for instance, lobbying actions or affiliations mediated through firms' executives and other board members. Combining key elements of these three perspectives, that is to say, the characterization of the social origins, educational backgrounds, and careers, first, the identification of crucial positions in the production, distribution, and consumption processes, second, and eventually the tracking of conduits of influence on lawmaking, the implementation of regulations and public decisions. Combining these key elements help us contribute to the study of what we would call the structure of economic power. And now that I very briefly presented these three perspectives on economic power, let's move on to the forms of economic power that we will try to grasp and analyze in our study. All of what concerns the production of goods or the provision of services, their exchange and consumption, as well as the allocation of wealth used by all these human activities, define the economy, very broadly speaking. And being economically powerful means to be in such a position that one of the four factors of production is within one's grasp, or that one has the ability to direct the course of the exchanges of these factors of production, goods and services. In capitalist societies, economic power relies on property rights, lines of command, and asymmetric interdependencies within and between organization, as well as rule of exchanges. These rights and rules are the byproduct of agonistic processes, power struggles between representatives of general and private interests, and these actors are interdependent but unequally powerful. For instance, politicians, high civil servants, and judges have the authority to establish rules including those governing the accumulation, the legal accumulation of capital, and also rules organizing the competition between firms. On the other hand, considering the state's elected or appointed officials as mere referees, impartially resolving disputes over business matters, would be forgetting that government and their administration are also economic actors in as much as they participate in the production, exchange, and consumption of goods and services as clients, producers, or investors. And last but not least, we should always keep in mind that the fiscal and financial resources of states, as well as their policies, depend on economic processes too. Consequently, in capitalist society, we would consider economic power as mainly taking two forms: the influence of some firms over their suppliers, employees, rivals, and clients, and on the other hand, the hold of powerful economic actors on other domains of activity, especially politics and the state administration. What is the research object, the study of the structure of economic power? What we would like to do in this presentation is to make explicit the system of relations between positions from which actors, firms, or individuals endowed with differentiated and unequal resources can make decisions that affect the economy. Well, so what? Well, very broadly speaking, that's a spoiler. We could say that what we tend to describe is how economic power is exercised in ways that differ according to the firm's characteristics and the trajectories of those who run them. And that's what we would like to do empirically. Let's move on to the existing result for France. We will mainly focus on the French case today, and we'll try to, later in the presentation, we'll try to see to which extent we can use the same variables and modalities for the French case and other cases in different countries. So existing results. We could say that in France, I don't know how it is in other countries, but at least in France, French scholars have long favored what we could call some sort of a social movement approach to the study of economic power. Apart from one PhD in economics in the early 1960s, most work focused at that time on bosses' organizations, their mobilization during the Popular Front, for instance, or how bosses' organizations coped with the advance of the left in time of Cold War. I especially refer to this book by Henri Weber, a former leftist student in 1960s, turned into a socialist senator, member of the French Senate, in the 1980s, who published this book, Le Parti des Patrons, the Bosses' Party in the mid-1980s. A bit later, I would say in the late 70s, economic historians and sociologists entered in scientific controversies upon the boundaries of organized business and the morphology of entrepreneurs as a social group. For instance, there was a very famous controversy in France between Bourdieu and Saint-Martin, on the one hand, two sociologists, and Lévy Le Boyer, who was a prominent economist and historian. And we could say that the paper published in 1978 by Bourdieu and Saint-Martin, Le Patronat, was a direct response to Lévy and Le Boyer, whose studies demonstrated that French entrepreneurs were modern capitalists, that is to say, innovative, rational, and pragmatic, despite an environment long defined by an under-educated workforce, a low productivity agricultural sector, and a threatening organized labor in a domestic economy very much influenced by a centralized government and family businesses. In his views, in Lévy Le Boyer's views, banks should be excluded from the analysis, since most of them were either state controlled or family owned in post-war France. On the contrary, Bourdieu and Saint-Martin included banks and public firms in their study, and their analysis of the French field of economic power was based on prosopography for the CEOs of the top 200 companies in terms of annual revenues. They collected information on social origins, secondary and higher education, careers, but also lifestyle, social status, and public recognition, as well as affiliations to business organizations and social clubs. Bourdieu and Saint-Martin identify two main forms of differentiation and one principle of hierarchization. I'm really sorry, I'm gonna have to use this word hierarchy and hierarchization, and for a reason that I ignore, that's a word that I cannot pronounce in English. So, please do receive my apology for that. So differentiations and one principle of hierarchization. More precisely, they oppose the presidents of state-controlled companies, often the sons of civil servants, grand école alumni, and usually nominated in the most selective core of the French bureaucracy. The people in this group have like a high media visibility, and they oppose this first group to private bosses who run family, smaller businesses after less prestigious education in private institutions, more often located outside of the Paris region. On the other hand, the second axis in their analysis was class seniority, and it distinguished well-established individuals in the financial fraction of the upper bourgeoisie to relative newcomers more inclined to have the upper hand on industrial companies. And the third axis in the analysis actually was offered some sort of refinement to better understand these two fractions, since the third axis distinguishes two fractions of the within the French bourgeoisie, those newcomers who accessed their position of power through academic success in the most selective engineering schools, namely Polytechnique, Mines et Ponts, while well-established bourgeois obtained from Sciences Po the ex post academic legitimation to occupy the position that they already acquired or were about to acquire by birth or marriage. This structure has proven to be quite robust, we could say, and François and Le Mercier, in their paper published in 2016, obtained rather similar results for the first two axes, despite the restructuring of the French economy by nationalizations in 1982, privatization starting in 1987, and changes in the corporate governance of publicly listed companies or firms controlled by private equity firms nowadays. For those of you who are interested in this debate between Lévy-Leboyer and Bourdieu and Saint-Martin, there's a podcast that you can listen to on the French equivalent of the BBC, even though there's no equivalent to the BBC, France Culture, and it's a 90-minute long debate between Lévy-Leboyer, Bourdieu, Michel Perrault, and Fridançon. Upon the business history, but also the sociology of bosses and bosses organization. Now let's move to the second section, sources and methods. Here, I think we're starting to enter the uncharted territories, let's say. So what are the sources that we could use here for this a specific paper, but also for the grandiose project that we all share, a comparative project with our colleagues in different countries. Well, first we could start to use national statistics, public statistics, and I will more precisely insist on Enquête Emploi, which is the French version of the labor force survey defined by the European Union. So it's something which is available in most European countries, and it can actually give us the possibility to get a first glance at who are the and what are the social characteristics of the people who run companies, especially if we have a better look at three categories, categories 23, 37 and 38, that is to say managers of companies with 10 or more employees, administrative and commercial managers of companies, and 38, which is which stands for engineers and company managers. Of course, we could also combine this with a selection criteria based on the size of the company to only capture the managers and executives of larger companies. There's another survey that is extremely interesting, which is called Formation et Qualification Professionnelle, which provides data to study occupational mobility, social mobility, and the relationship between initial and vocational training, employment, and salary. The problem is that, like, we don't have it on a regular basis. We have previous surveys, but it's not on a regular basis as the labor force survey. Then there's a second source that we're going to use, and we'll discuss this with our colleagues. It's like a rich list. So in France, the rich list is published by Challenge, which is a weekly newspaper. The rich list has existed since 1996. And let's be clear, we use it, even though the rich list has its limitations, and these limitations are similar to other rankings published by Forbes or publication like the Sunday Times in England. What are these limitations? Well, they tend to underestimate the reported wealth, since they only publicize the value of the assets the journalists have the proof of belonging to individuals who do not all stand out for their financial transparency. For assets that are publicly traded, large swings in stock prices may impact the rankings from one year to another, it's clear. And for assets that are not publicly traded, the valuation process is even more equivocal. Moreover, these lists tend to conflate family wealth with individuals' wealth, since journalists do not systematically have information about the legal arrangements that exist between parents, siblings, and so on. You can see on the slide, so that's the distribution of wealth in the rich list published in 2020 and the rich list published in 2015. Just to give you an idea, among the people listed in 2015, more than 70% were still present in 2020. But as you can see, there's obviously a rise in accumulated wealth by those individuals or families. I must say that the French rich list is very much skewed by one guy, who's Bernard Arnault, the head of LVMH. So he's the guy who owns now more than 100 billion euros. He multiplied his wealth by 3 in 5 years, which is quite a lot. Another sources that we will resort to is the Who's Who. So the Who's Who in France provide uniform and verified biographical information on 22,000 plus individuals who occupy prominent positions in politics, administration, business, and media. This source has its limitations too, and these limitations are well documented. Underrepresentation of business people, with the exception of CEOs of large company, which is a plus for us, but also with the exception of consultants and auditors, which is a plus, it's kind of okay, as well as high civil servants in charge of the economy, which is also a plus. There's also an overrepresentation of activities whose representatives are visible in the media, especially the leaders of business organizations, lobbies, unions, to a lesser extent. one of the key problems is that there are lots of missing biographies, either for reason of privacy, it's especially true for high civil servants, but also for some subparts of the population that we have an interest in. You'll see this later. Just to give you an idea, our study population is 369 individuals, and only 2/3 of them had their biographies in the Who's Who, which means that on top of those, on top of the Who's Who, we also resort to other sources of information, especially sites for fans of genealogy, in which you can actually do more refined prosopography. Another source which is extremely important for us, and which is not necessarily often used by social scientists, is Orbis. So Orbis is an online database run by Bureau van Dijk, which is owned by Moody's, the rating agency. It provides information in Excel or CSV format about hundreds of millions of companies worldwide. Those information come from official registers, annual reports, company websites, news wires, telephone research, and direct correspondence with the companies. So it's very useful in order to get information not on the individuals, but on the organization they run. The problem here, there are two problems. One, which is linked to the kind of the fact that the way Orbis function is that you usually, especially if you use Orbis from an academic institution, is that usually academic institutions have a limited number of credits, that is to say downloaded searches. So in order not to cost a fortune to your institution, you should make sure that what you download is really what you want, because otherwise you may actually waste a lot of credits that might have been useful for other researchers. The other problem is that yes, you have lots of information, but most of this information needs to be recoded. And this, we'll come back to this later. Now that we're clear about the kind of sources that we mainly resort to, let's talk about the making of the study population. So the selection principle for sketching the structure of economic power the control over the means of production on the one hand, and the asymmetric co-production of economic rules. Well, the first principle is pretty much obvious, the control over the means of production. And what it means for contemporary France is that we first select those who control the means of production as owners or executive managers of large companies, be they private, publicly listed, or state controlled. Thus, we include in the study population individuals ranked in the Challenge Rich List, as well as the president of the board or the managing directors of the most capitalized publicly listed companies. There's a stock index in France called the Euronext SBF 120. It's like the top 120 market cap in Paris. But we also decided to take into account individuals who run firms in which the state holds controlling stakes. Here, the key question for us was what kind of threshold should we fix? And we opted for a common threshold for corporate wealth and publicly listed companies, €500 million, which corresponded in 2015 to the smallest capitalization in the SBF 120 index and to the wealth of the 124th individual in the challenge ranking. The idea was to say, those people, they basically have the upper hand on a similar amount of capital. Whether or not the company is listed is another question. And that's this threshold, and that's why it's highlighted in yellow. that's something we should actually discuss in the, I think, later on. The second principle of selection is, we think, a bit more original. The idea was to say that we wanted to identify organizations as well as individuals that participate in the making and implementation in France, the making and implementation of economic laws and regulations. These entities can influence public authorities and regulators, can also draft rules or control the compliance. Therefore, we decided to include the head of the companies that are affiliated to the main corporate lobby in France called AFEP, l'Association Française des Entreprises Privées. Just to give you an idea of its 112 members, only 6 are listed in the challenge rich list, but 63 are also part of the SBF 120. The 33 remaining members of AFEP are mainly the head of French subsidiaries of foreign multinationals like ExxonMobil, HSBC, IBM, Nestle, or Rio Tinto, as well as the heads of small investment banks that are not necessarily huge in terms of total assets, but extremely influential, at least in the French context, such as Lazard Bank, the Rothschild Bank, and Neuflis, which is which used to be the investment bank of the Protestant rich families in France. We also include the presidents of official business unions, business organizations, as well as the president of the main farmers association, because by law in France, these organizations participate in collective bargaining, and they also co-run with a legally recognized workers union, the unemployment benefit, as well as the compulsory supplementary pension schemes. It's exactly for the same reason that we first decided to include the head of the 6 major trade unions, even though their social characteristics differ so much from the rest of the study population that we had to put them aside. Last but not least, we considered that, like, if we go on with this second principle, selection principle based on this idea of an asymmetric co-production of economic rules, we should also have some high civil servants, such as the central bank governor and his deputy, or the head of the treasury unit that manage the public debt, but also the general directorate of the taxation, enterprise, and labor departments, as well as the head of the financial markets and competition authorities. Here, and that's also why we decided to highlight it, this in yellow, it's the moment you enter, you decide to open the state Pandora's box. The question is, like, where do you stop? We decided to only include in the study population individuals whose occupy positions from which they can make crucial decisions that affect how stuff are produced, how markets function, and how companies finance their activity. But keep in mind, there's this threshold issue we should discuss, and this other problem, which is, where do we stop when we open the state's Pandora's box? For the thresholds, I think that we cannot decide from scratch what would be the threshold in different countries, but we could at least agree upon general principles, national jurisdictions, intersectoral scope for regulators, and also, we should not lose the idea that, like, we're going to have to treat EU institutions and actors as a country in our collective endeavor. So the study population consists of 369 individuals and 311 organizations. Now let's move on to the variables. I think it's really important to discuss about the variables. Basically, we decided to have two type of variables, variables that characterize individuals, and more precisely, how do they get access to their position of economic power. I listed them here. I will not define them one by one, but we can go back to this a bit later. And also variables, and you'll get the funny joke about a guy you never heard of later. And also variables on organizations. I would like to insist on this because maybe it's a bit less, it's a bit more original than the way we decided to code education. The idea here was to have information on organizations, so about their creation, their location, but also we were like, okay, if we consider that like being economically powerful means that you have some sort of influence on the main factors of production, we thought that it was important to construct variables that could actually give us an idea of the kind of power that organization exerts on, for instance, the land and its soils, and the kind of energy, the land and its soils, but also the kind of power that a company or an organization can have on a market. It's not the same thing to be like the first producer on a production market, or to be to occupy a crucial position in the distribution or allocation of goods, services, or capital, or to play a role which has much to do with regulation or providing advices like consulting firms or auditing firms. That's why we designed those first two variables: power land on the one hand and power market on the other hand. Power capital refers to the total asset of the organizations. And here the idea was to say, well, we would like to have a variable that gives us an idea of the sheer size of the entity, but also an aggregate. We wanted also to have a variable that could work as some sort of a proxy for the capacity and also the willingness of an organization to enter into collective action. And we consider that like the total asset is a pretty good indicator of that, because like if you have a huge total asset, it means that you have vested interest in making sure that things works the way you would like them to work in different domain of activities. Then we, thanks to Orbis, we created this geospread variables, which refer to the number of countries in which the organization operates, and also something which is called public cible, which is completely silly if you do not speak French. It refers to the type of clients or users served by the organization. Just one more thing about the variables. I think that there's one discussion that we should have on the definition of the variables, but then the modalities may differ from one country to another. I'll give you the example of the creation date, for instance. So it's the date of creation of the organization, and we have a series of dates, and then we can get the distribution, and then the question is like, how do you create modalities, categorical variables? And here the problem is, we were like, okay, we're gonna try to construct modalities that are based upon what we know about the economic history of our country, France in this case. And that's why, for instance, a very simple way to do it was to have to say, okay, there will be one cut in 1947 because it's the beginning of the Cold War. It's the moment when the Communist Party got expelled from the government, and it's the beginning of the reconstruction and the rise of state capitalism in the context of Cold War. Whereas 1987 is the first year for privatization in France, and you could say that it's a good starting point to characterize the situation we're still in nowadays.
Paul, can I just say about 10 minutes left?
Yeah, no problems.
Okay, guys. Thank you.
We're gonna go for the results. So, so what we decided to do was like a geometric data analysis. I will not enter into further details. If you have questions, you can ask Josh or other people in the Zoom room. So the results. First, some descriptive stats on the structure of shareholdings in the top 50 listed companies. Just to give you an example of on how the French state shrunk in size. If you take the current situation nowadays, you could say that like nowadays, the French state control 4% of the market capitalization, whereas the three richest family in France control more than 18% of this market cap. And then you, in second position, you'll have the big three studied by the Corpnet teams in Amsterdam, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard. And after that, the French banking oligopoly. I will skip the descriptive public stats. Just keep in mind that buses in France are still very much defined by social origins, and there are lots of them have their fathers who used to be craft people, craftsmen, tradesmen, or general manager of corporations with more than 10 employees. Let's go to the specific multiple correspondence analysis that we propose you to analyze. So obviously you have two axes that we decided to talk about. Here is the cloud of individuals. As you can see, the shape of the cloud of the cloud is not too problematic. Here are the most contributive modalities. So if you look at the first two axes, organizational variables define more than half of the variance, and so that means that like what we know about and what we decided to code about firms account for half of the first axis and half of the second axis. Nonetheless, here you can see now, so I will, that's what I'm going to describe more precisely. When you look at this cloud of modalities, what do you have? Well, the first axis, horizontal, opposes ENARC, people who studied at ENARC, l'École Nationale d'Administration, and to a lesser extent, people trained in law or in the humanities on the right side of the graph. And they run organizations that tend to regulate, certify, or provide consulting services in France. And this group is opposed to people who inherited their companies, which are based outside of the Paris region. They tend to produce goods or provide services that require the exploitation of land or soil. And much more often, these companies are very much internationalized. The second axis opposes engineers who run like national champions, which serve both individuals and businesses in France and abroad, to relatively smaller B2C companies run by people who did not receive a scientific education. If you want to have an idea of like who are the most extreme individuals, basically on the right side, you have the head of the taxation department at the Ministry of Finance versus the guy who inherited and ran a company called Rémy Cointreau, famous for his rum, gin, and cognac. The second axis opposes the head of Total, the major French oil company, to a guy called, so I have a problem with his name. His name is Casgrain, and he inherited and ran a company called Longchamp, famous for his like bags and accessories. In England, for instance, Kate Moss used to be the public figure for this French brand. They have completely different trajectories. Pouyanné, he's like the typical French engineer, whereas Casgrain, his father was used to run a tobacco shop in Paris 10th arrondissement, and his company is totally private and now run by his kids, who own and control. So purely private companies. So what can we say from that? And that's going to be the discussion, but also our concluding remarks. First of all, I think that like one of the key problems when we try to do the sort of stuff that we're presenting is that like one of the questions that we should have in mind is like, are we only rediscovering our selection principles? And if you look at the shape and intersections of ellipse on this graph, they tend to indicate that the units of analysis that we constructed that combine individual characteristics and organizational characteristics clearly overlap, which means that like, yes, it's obvious that stuff that are related to the state are more on the right side of the first axis, where the hairs on the left side. But nonetheless, you can see that like each and every time, the two ellipses clearly overlap. That's why we decided to try to do a cluster analysis to identify four types of economically powerful. And we could say that like, generally speaking, in the in our plan, in our first plan, with the first and two axis, yeah, the first axis and the second axis, this first plan corresponds to the updating of the classical opposition since the work of Fernand Braudel between actors of the market economy and capitalists. The actors of the market economy, on the right side of the graph, they tend to operate on a national scale, which in French implies that you have to deal with the administration and the remains of state capitalism, while the capitalist, according to the word of the expression of Braudel, project internationally the companies they manage and partly own. Each of these poles can be associated with different forms of economic power: the regulation of domestic activity, the allocation within the national boundaries of credits and capital, versus the production of goods and provision of services in France and abroad. Our four types of economically powerful could be, on the one hand, the provincial heirs running intermediate size enterprise. That would be one type. A second one would be publicly listed national champions run by top engineers. And then there will be in blue, the well-educated in business and management UPs, usually working for finance, insurance, or real estate companies, mainly from Paris. And last but not least, the purple on the far right, that consists in the most politicized and public fraction of our study population. Just to give you some very last result, when we were discussing about at the very beginning of this project, we're like, okay, maybe we should also use a media visibility index to get some individuals. Look at what would have happened if we had only construct the population on media visibility. Basically, as you can see, the index of media visibility aligned to the second axis, which means that we would have mainly collect and identify individuals on organizations that are the largest company, usually publicly listed companies, and we would have lost all the family businesses that still very much run the French economy. And we observe the same result when we think about social capital. You can see that like the measure of centrality in the network of board membership, as well as affiliation to the main business organization or the organization that contribute the most to lobbying activities in France or in the European Union, they're all in the upper middle of the chart. If we had decided to enter by from a lobbying perspective or just an affiliation network perspective, certainly we would have lost a lot of the population. Our concluding remarks. I think that in this draft, in this presentation, which is still very much, I repeat, a work in progress, we provide a simpler space than the one initially investigated by Bourdieu, Saint-Martin, and their followers, such as François and Le Mercier. Now the state and its affiliated entities mainly regulate or allocate capital to private or publicly listed companies when they face difficulties. On the other hand, our study documents the power of family capitalism, family businesses. And here the important point is to keep in mind that in our situation, family capitalism, family businesses also consist in very, very large businesses, which was not necessarily the case in the 19th century and first part of the 20th century in France, at least. For instance, the daughter of Bernard Arnault, Delphine Arnault, that you can see here with her husband, Xavier Niel. They just had a daughter and their daughter, the daughter of Delphine Arnault and Xavier Niel, will combine the wealth and power of the number one and number 12 in our 2020 rich list. This should encourage us to design research strategy that would make it possible to do prosopography like historians do, that is to say, to find ways to get more information about marriage and relations based upon marital alliances. Nonetheless, if I had to say one more thing, I would say that like the key strengths of the analysis that we provide is the combination of organizational and individual variables. I'm not sure that we will all have the same modalities, but we should keep in mind for this wet project, this idea to construct spaces, to construct the structure of economic power based upon variables and information, then combine information on organizations and on individuals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we can't clap so easily by on the Zoom, but anyway, thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you. So we have about 20 minutes, a bit more perhaps, for comments and discussions and thoughts. Who would like to begin? Felix.
Yes, thank you very much, Paul. I was wondering, you were showing very quickly the ownership of the French economy, and you showed also that these new asset managers, the American asset managers, Vanguard, BlackRock, Fidelity, and these guys, they have also become important in France. They have a certain weight in the French economic field. So I was wondering, do you see any influence of these new managers? Because there's this discourse in political economy that these are the new owners, the new powerful actors on the international scene, and also in different countries. So how would these actors relate to the different fractions that you have shown us? So can you say that certain of these fractions are more under the influence of these guys, or can we see in a certain way that the influence of these new international actors have have the different fractions, have they moved in a certain way? Have they reacted to these new actors, these new powerful actors? Have they integrated, or are certain under pressure and others, for example, the smaller ones who are not on the stock market, have they been less influenced by these actors? What is happening there?
Do you want to reply to each question, Paul? Probably best to reply. Would you like to gather some questions? Yeah, yeah. Reply them, please. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Hello. Let me. Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just. Thank you, Felix, for your questions. So this is pictures. Can you see the pictures?
Yes.
So these are pictures of the last demonstration in the street of Paris about the pension reform. And I think that was the very first time that actors like BlackRock got identified and vilified by demonstrators in France. So that would be a first way to answer your question. Obviously, when this pension reform was proposed by the government before the COVID-19 crisis unleashed, they were very much in the conversation. More sociologically speaking, I would say that when you look at who are the people who represent BlackRock in France, for instance, well, it is the kind of people that you'll see on the right side of our space. That is to say, people who tended to work for instance, public institutions, financial public institutions, or former public companies who decided to work for the private sector, and some of them became the heads of BlackRock in France, for instance. The interesting thing that we should all keep in mind is the fact that the French in France there is no pension funds. Which may explain the reason why there are some open space for institutional investors to invest in the largest publicly listed companies. But in terms of the social characteristics of those who represent those actors in France, I mean, they are very similar to the people who tend to run banks or public companies. That is to say, former high civil servant trained at ENA, who worked for the Ministry of Finance and then decided to go private.
Thank you, Paul. Asif, you raised your hand. Yeah.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Paul. This was very interesting. Speaking on behalf of the German team today, we're still in the process of identifying the sort of population of interest for our study. I have a question on the forms of economic power you were referring to. How did you classify companies that are important in the supply chain, but not necessarily the ones selling the final product? I was thinking about large suppliers to even larger manufacturing companies in particular, in Germany, especially because of the car industry, right? So because you said it might be another form of economic power having some sort of influence on the factors of production, right? And the lines of command, as you put it. So these suppliers might not be listed in the top stock indexes, but I think they're still very important. So can you give us some advice how to handle these sort of companies and their chair people and so on?
Thank you, Asif. I'm not sure that I should thank you for this question, actually. It's a really, really difficult one. So first, I'm going to try to tell us what we did. and you'll see the limits of it. So the idea for us was to say, okay, we said, okay, power land is a variables that indicates that an entity exploits the soils, extracts, transforms, or transport natural resources or agricultural goods. And then we're like, okay, we will go for power capital based on the total assets. And then, let's face it, we struggle a lot to get a more refined classification. So one obvious start would be the NASI classification. The problem with the NASI classification is that, like, the problem that we had is that, like, it's extremely precise, but it was very difficult for us to construct modalities that would statistically be large enough to be used in the MCA. So, for instance, to give you an idea, we're like, okay, the easiest way was to say, okay, manufacturing and commerce would be one thing, and then we say, okay, we have enough people to split commerce and manufacturing, which sometimes a bit difficult. And then the problem is that because we have a not that large population, the split within manufacturing became a bit difficult. Nonetheless, I think that on the long to-do list that we have, it is something that we should definitely discuss. More precisely, I think that the way to discuss it is to come with the list of the companies, start from the NASI classification, and see how we can make this. The problem that, to give you an idea for the car industry, for instance, in France, we do have also a smaller car industry with suppliers, but the suppliers are very, very, there was a huge concentration among the suppliers, and we mainly have two, Faurecia and Valeo. And it was not enough to make a statistical a category out of this. But I would say start with the NASI, and the limit in the classification will be given by the size of the number of units you'll have in for each modalities. That's the only way to do it.
Well, we have Victoria and Christoph with hands up now. So why don't we have two questions and then turn back. Victoria, do you want to? Christoph, Victoria, you start, then Christoph, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Paul, thanks so much. I just had one question about the variables for the organizations and wondered whether you had kind of considered adding variables, for example, on which companies sit on certain advisory boards or advisory panels of the government. I don't know if that exists in France, but for example, in the UK, David Cameron started this business advisory group, which met quarterly with the Prime Minister. And then the second variable I was thinking about was like consulting contracts with the government. So are there certain companies that have like a disproportionate amount of consulting contracts, and have they increased? And then a question just out of interest, like how common is the so-called revolving door in France, where people kind of switch between public and private sector throughout their careers?
Christoph, let's let Christoph ask in order to give us
that
time.
Thank you, Paul, for a great presentation. And I hate to be the one saying this because I usually get this criticism myself. But I was wondering if included in the Pandora's box of the state, it would not be interesting to include if such people exist in France, like the key economic advisors, key economists who kind of import or shape, in a sense, the rule. In our Danish context, it would have been basically the economic professors on the government's economic council, and that would be it. But how, I mean, at least a lot of economic sociology is also about how we criticize economists for their ideas, but we're in much of that, or also the constructivist political economy, the role of economic ideas and those who deliver them is at least in, very much in focus. So I was just wondering if you considered including them and where they would, you guessed they would fit in into the field of economic power in France.
Paul, do you want to reply to those two questions?
Yes. So I'll start with Victoria's questions. So what we did, well, it's not necessarily a good idea. It's a low prof, it's a low academic profitability variable. But what we did was to say, okay, we got this measure of centrality, which is based on affiliation network, from board members in the top 250 French companies. And we used it, we used this measure of centrality to assess one form of social capital that is very much defining those who run the national champions. Clearly, those are based on the boards that are considered here are not advisory boards, which means that like we obviously missing people who may occupy positions that are close to the executives and managers, that the C-suites, but not part of the organization as such. That is to say that like there are people who are not even independent board members, but just advisory members, and we don't have them. Here, the problem is that like the difficulties would be that we don't have a list, and especially for the family businesses, most of those companies are private companies. That in the true term of private companies, that like economically speaking, it's like they're not listed, which means that like they're not forced to make public lots of information. And I don't know how it is in other countries, but in France, if you do not, you by law, you should send to the commercial court, the Tribunal de Commerce, your financial statement and annual report. But it's an obligation, but the fine you pay is extremely low. Therefore, we do lack systematic information, which means that like the only way we could do this maybe is either through the biography, but this will mean that we'll screen biographies outside our study sample, and the question will be like, how much do we expend this? Concerning the question on the economist and should we add more individuals? So the way we did, we didn't do it. There's some sort of like council of economic advisor to the prime minister in France. So that would be possible. But I'm not sure that they have the same influence as they may have, for instance, in the US. The question for us would be, for instance, among the assemblies that exist, so you have the Senate, you have the Parliament. But you also have the Conseil économique, environnemental et social, which is some sort of just like, which is a gathering of former unionists, some intellectuals plus members of business organizations. we decided not to have them in the study population because they cannot make decisions that have some influence on how the economy functions. Nonetheless, among the corporate events that we decided to take into consideration, we chose to include something called les rencontres d'Aix. So it's a very French thing. It's like it's usually in July, and in Aix-en-Provence, you have lovely opera evenings. It's not like Glyndebourne, but I mean, you don't have the cows, but you have like the old Aix-en-Provence. And during the festival, a group of economists, very much like the one you refer to, Christophe, decided. More than a decade ago, to set this annual conference in which politicians, CEOs, and some economists chat. So we include them as an event. And obviously, the people who tend to attend this event are always the same guy on top of the second axis, with also usually the French CEOs of French CEOs of subsidiaries of international companies. That's what I can say.
Thank you. We should finish soon. Just to say there's some chat from Alchena, and the last point you make, Alchena, is about real world examples. This is absolutely a platform to take this work forward. So keep watching this space and keep watching other seminars. I just have one question to ask. And does anyone else before I ask my question? This is the last round. It's fascinating and incredibly painstaking work, and Paul and the team. I mean, brilliant work, and congratulations. As you were talking, I was thinking about what the implications are for kind of Piketty's interpretation of what's going on in contemporary capitalism. You know, his arguments about the rise of rentiers and the return of capital and all that. Because in a way, one way of reading your argument is to say that's a bit overblown, because you're still getting this world of corporate economic interests who are driving things. Now, of course, that raises the issue which you posed about the selection principles you used. And you obviously did use the wish list. So I guess that is taken account of, would you say? I mean, so would you want to push that argument forward and say, you know, let's not get too hung up about the return of rentiers and the return of capital, or not?
Well, I must say that one of the stuff that we were very much intrigued when we started this work was the, in our previous work, I think that we tended to underestimate the importance of family businesses, mm-hmm. Clearly. And the fact that when you look at the left side of the space, it's not only like people who run intermediate size companies from outside of Paris, because the very interesting thing is that like they're very much, very, very much internationalized, for instance.
Yes.
That's something that really struck us. That's one thing. The other thing, which is much more general, I think, is the fact that yes, you can observe a rise in the educational credentials that people who inherited their position of power and now run family businesses, it is clearly obvious that we observe a rise in educational credentials. Nonetheless, we can see that this rise, which is obvious when you see, for instance, when you consider, for instance, the proportion of people who went to business schools, not necessarily top tier business schools, but like business schools in general. That's something which is kind of new. The one of the limits, the strong limit that we have. So that's why I would not go for the full argument about the comeback of the rent here.
Yeah,
it might actually be worse than that. A combination of ranches with at least for sociologists, I would say, which is the combination of ranches with diploma, because the characteristics of the cultural bourgeoisie is like it tended to scorn the real bourgeois because they were rich but without with that diploma. Now they're rich and they also have the diploma, which also forces us maybe to change the way we think of them. And I think here the one of the difficulty at least that I face is the fact that like we tend to consider diploma as titles titles that contribute to the legitimation of individuals or group of individuals to occupy and exert forms of power. Might actually be true that like it's not that education diploma is not only about title of legitimation, but also they also have content. That is to say that like they may actually not only gain diploma, but also gain knowledge that change the way they exert power. It's obviously clear when you focus on those family businesses. The new generation, even if most of them do not have the full gear grande école thing as the usual French bosses tended to have, they combine and they complete their education with the MBAs, and for instance at INSEAD, which gives you the diploma, some sort of US kind of diploma without leaving France, which is something which might actually be important if you're actually running a company that is very much located in France, at least the headquarters. So I won't go for the full rentier argument. I think
it's interesting. The family, family dynasty. It's interesting.
That's here where actually being able to do a real prosopography would be amazing.
Yes. I think. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Francois and Sylvain. I think we should finish there. But it's a great platform to build upon. And in fact, this time next week we're having a presentation from the Danish team and the Swiss team, I think. So and these presentations are all linked together, so we can absolutely build upon what we've heard today. Thank you very much. And I hope to see you all next week, same time, same place, on Zoom.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.